In the first part of the show today, the first hour, we'll be talking about what it means to be young, poor, and black in our consumer culture. And our guest for the program is Elizabeth Chin. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And we'll be talking about some work that she did in New Haven, Connecticut, where over the period of a couple of years, she spent time with some 10-year-old poor and working-class black kids who lived there and looked at their, in her words, their entanglements with the world of consumption. She's written about this in her book, Purchasing Power, Black Kids and American Consumer Culture. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. We thought it might make an interesting conversation, and she agreed to spend some time with us this morning talking about it. As we do, questions, comments, of course, are welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. But anyone can call in. If it would be long-distance call for you, use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. So anyone's welcome to call. We just ask people to try and be brief in their comments so that we can keep things moving along. But anyone can call 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Chin, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Among the many different sorts of things that one might do if you were going to look at the lives of young disadvantaged kids in this country, mm-hmm. you probably do a lot of different sorts of things. What was it about this particular angle that interested you and led you to explore something that I think, at least you say in the book, hadn't really gotten a lot of attention from academics before?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess for me, the basic question was, we have this consumer culture that puts so much information out, especially toward children. And at the time that I began my research, that had been intensifying kind of dramatically between the deregulation of children's television and increasing direct marketing to kids that was beginning earlier and earlier. And at the same time, we had these increasing disparities in socioeconomic groups. And so the question for me really became, given the huge amount of advertising and pressure aimed at kids, what about the kids that really couldn't respond to that by buying things? So that was where I started from.
Yeah, so they're just you begin with the idea that they are just as much, you know, swimming in this consumerist sea as everyone else,
uh-huh.
exposed to all of the intense messages about what we should want and how that's going to make us happy,
uh-huh.
and yet they have the disadvantage over a lot of other consumers, and that they cannot freely go out and indulge that desire.
Exactly, mm. exactly. And I think complicating that is a common, especially I think media portrayal of those particular children having those desires very strongly, but the way that they satisfy those desires is to go out and do really problematic things like robbing or carjacking or stealing. And I found those images to be very disturbing and problematic, and so my question was, is this in fact going on?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, what are they doing?
There, you point to the fact that there have been occasionally in the media some high-profile stories about that very thing, particularly about the fact that that these kids are so obsessed with particular things and particular brands,
uh-huh.
things that are very expensive, that they can't get them otherwise. And and in particular, the stories that maybe will resonate with people or that they remember are stories about one young person attacking another to get their jacket or to get their shoes or to get their jewelry or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And it would be easy to think, after having seen a few of these stories, that somehow they are representative of the larger community, which it seems pretty clear that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the image that a lot of people, I think, are left with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And one can't deny that that does occasionally happen. But it's not the whole story. And it's not, I think, the majority of what goes on. And I think another thing to remember is that I was working with 10-year-olds and not 18-year-olds, for instance. And I think there is a change that happens where, you know, as people get older and bigger and more able to act independently and also working or able to earn money, that the way that they're engaged with, you know, being able to satisfy their desires does shift a little bit.
Well, what about that image of one kid essentially attacking another to get their shoes or their jacket? Does that, I mean, we know that it has happened, but what does one say about what that means and, in fact, whether that's some kind of anomaly or that that's something that's common?
I guess, you know, from my field work, where I was, again, in New Haven for a couple of years, I certainly never saw that happen, didn't hear about it happening. I was in, you know, the neighborhood all the time and around people of all different ages. But again, that the media and, you know, the local media as well as the national media were still reporting on those things, particularly, or another version of it is being obsessed with the kinds of possessions that, you know, quote, drug dealers have. I remember one story that was in the local paper was, you know, saying things like, oh, these guys who were members of this drug gang, which they were, paid for NBA basketball tickets with cash. You know? And as if that alone was some kind of marker or crime. And, you know, I'm not in support of drug dealers. I think that's a really problematic way to make money. But what starts to happen is that anything that people who are thought to be associated with that have somehow becomes a signal that, you know, they're engaged in these bad activities. Whereas, again, paying for a basketball ticket with cash is not necessarily a problem.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is Elizabeth Chin. She is associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at Occidental College, which is in Los Angeles. And we're talking about a study that she did in New Haven, Connecticut, looking at some young African-American kids who lived there and their ideas about participation in American consumer culture. And it's available in a book form, by the way, if you'd like to look at it. The title of the book is Purchasing Power, Black Kids and American Consumer Culture, published by the University of Minnesota Press. So you actually grew up in New Haven.
I did. I did. And, you know, it's interesting because anthropologists usually go away to, you know, far away exotic places, but increasingly people are looking at the United States and, you know, sort of going home to do field work. And, you know, there were certain similarities that I had in my life to these children, but at the same time, I grew up in a very different New Haven than these kids. New Haven is a very segregated city in all kinds of ways. You know, it's segregated by residential areas. The schools are basically segregated. So the school that I spent a lot of time with had three students who were white, and everybody else was black or Hispanic. And so it was going home for me, but it was also not, because this was not really, the you know, the town that I had grown up in is not the town where these kids were living.
Mm-hmm. You spent most of the time with some girls, these 10-year-old girls.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
That happened kind of naturally. I think the girls gravitated toward me a little more, especially early on. And I guess the one who I became very especially close to is called Tiana in the book. And all of the children, you know, I use pseudonyms for all of them. And she had had a really rough, at 10, had already had a pretty rough time. Her mother had just been killed a year earlier in a drug-related incident. and she was living with her grandmother, who I think was having some drug problems. It was never something that I discussed with them directly, but that seemed to be pretty clearly going on. And living also with her great-grandmother, who had a lot of health problems. And she was, you know, this incredibly sort of sensitive and also needy child. And I think, you know, I sort of arrived on the scene at a time where I was probably not a lot older than her mother. And so, you know, she developed a close relationship with me during that time that I was there. And then there was Natalia, who was also a good friend of hers, who lived around the corner, who was living with her grandparents, and her mother lived nearby, and so she would kind of shuttle back and forth between those households. Partly, her grandmother was a pastor at the church, and Natalia would often manage to get over to her mother's house just in time to miss, you know, Thursday night services. You know? So she was pretty good at, you know, directing her life.
Yeah, ministers' kids, they're trouble.
Yeah.
We've seen it again and again.
Yeah, so they were, you know, they were interesting, smart, funny kids who were just a lot of fun to be around, too. Yeah. And they really, you know, I was this, you know, kind of clueless graduate student running around in this tough neighborhood where people who don't live there walk around. You know, they don't walk around. And I think they really saw themselves as protecting me, because I think they didn't think I knew how to take care of myself. And so, for instance, they would walk me to the edge of the neighborhood when I was leaving at the end of the day. They would very carefully, you know, they would sort of get on either side of me, and they'd say, no, don't walk down that street. No, see those guys? Don't go over there, you know. And they would make sure that I got out of there safely. And so they, you know, kind of showed me the ropes.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that I think within anthropology,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure how many years back this goes, maybe at least a decade or more,
mm-hmm.
there has been this growing feeling that maybe what anthropologists should do is, rather than going and studying a very different culture with all the sort of baggage that's involved in that,
mm-hmm.
it maybe make more sense for them to apply the discipline to studying their own.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you've done that because you did your fieldwork here in the United States. And
mm-hmm.
at the same time, I suppose some people would say, in a way, you were, though, studying a culture that was not your own, just because that there were these big differences in your not just your ethnic background, but also your class background between yourself
mm-hmm.
and the people that were studying. And I wonder, and I'm sure that was something that you thought about. How did that complicate what it was you were trying to do?
Yeah, it was. I had to think about that a lot. I mean, I'm half Chinese and half Caucasian, and I was working in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. But I think the real difference between me and the people there was really my class. And not so much, I mean, I grew up poor, and we were on welfare when I was a child, but my mother had come from a middle-class family, and so I was able to go to private school, for instance, even though we didn't pay for it. So I had experiences that these children, you know, in these amazingly... their public school was very interesting, but the public schools in New Haven don't have particularly good resources. You know, the state almost every year has taken the New Haven public schools to court to force the city to pay the minimum amount per student mandated by the state. So, you know, the schools have been in deep trouble for some time. So, for instance, one of the things that a lot of people would ask me when they first would meet me was whether I was connected to Yale, which is, you know, the big university in town. And when I would say no, they would say, oh, well, then I'll talk to you. And I think that's an indicator of the kind of class tension that exists in New Haven. and tension that is often focused around the university and around professional people who come to study people in New Haven, who are many of them in poverty and in very difficult circumstances, and that they're aware that that's a kind of unequal situation where, again, professionals with big grants who have, you know, nice homes and good careers are coming to learn about people who are barely making it, and, you know, they pay them $10 for their interview and then say, thank you very much, I'll see you later. Mm-hmm. And they were not particularly happy about that. So I think not being connected to the university was something they saw as, in some degree, separating me from, you know, these issues that they were uncomfortable with. But it continues to make me uncomfortable that, you know, here I am in my lovely college in Los Angeles with this book coming out, speaking about the poverty of people who I knew very intimately. And one of the, I think, small ways that I'm dealing with that is that I'm not making any money off the book. All of my royalties are being donated to a scholarship foundation in New Haven for the children who come from that neighborhood.
Did the girls that you spent time with, did they really understand what it was you were interested in?
You know, I think they did and they didn't. I think for them, the main thing was that I was a grown-up who was interested in them and who talked to them. And I don't think, you know, what I was doing mattered to them the way it did to me. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I did do as part of the research was to teach a number of the children about anthropology. And they actually went out and did a study, interviewed people, learned about their community, and, you know, wrote up a report, presented the report to their school and to the citywide PTA, and I actually had them also present that work to my graduate department in New York City, which was, you know, it was a lot of fun for me to see all of my professors who'd been torturing me for so long, you know, have to sit there and listen to a bunch of 10-year-old kids. So they learned, I think, a little bit about where I was coming from and, you know, what I did, but certainly I don't think it was, they weren't finished learning that by the time I was done.
I think that we know sort of in our hearts, and as much as we also might know that it's not healthy, that maybe one of our problems in this country is that an awful lot of people, different socioeconomic levels, define their well-being by the stuff that they have.
Uh-huh.
It's our material. You know, we know whether we're happy because of the stuff that we have, and
uh-huh.
we want stuff, and it's very difficult to, you know, fight those desires. And we also know that a lot of people, even people who have money, are overextended because they have bought stuff that they didn't need and they probably don't really even want. So
right.
it can be a problem for people of means. But here now, mm-hmm. here's a fundamental question of this whole thing is how is it that people who don't have a lot of money to spend mm-hmm. deal with those same forces of desire that are operating on us and telling us mm-hmm. that here's all this great stuff that we really should have.
Mm-hmm.
How does one deal with that when you simply don't have the money to indulge that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, as you say, that's the key question. And I think it's incredibly difficult and complicated. And, you know, there are a lot of different levels. I think sometimes when we think of consumption, we tend to think about, you know, buying toys or buying cars or, you know, shopping for clothes or, you know, things that you, as you said, you might not necessarily need. But I think it's also useful to think about consumption in terms of paying your rent, being able to buy a home. That is a form of consumption. And when I thought about and looked at the consumption of children and families in that wider context, I think I could begin to see some of what these families were up against. Many of the families were, you know, on welfare, either temporarily or long-term. Other families were more complicated. Again, children were living with their grandparents, and often these grandparents were retired and living on relatively small pensions. They had perhaps been able to buy a home, but the homes were maybe not in such good condition, so, you know, they were having to spend money on upkeep. And, for instance, grocery shopping for these families. Only 40% of the families in the area where I did my work had cars. And New Haven at that time only had two major grocery stores within its borders. And this is a city of 130,000 people. So people who needed to buy food for their houses and their families either had to, you know, if they had a car, they could drive to the grocery store, which was over 2 miles away. They could take the bus. And if you're a mother with children, taking the bus with your kids and then lugging all the groceries home is a pretty big chore. They could take a taxi, which adds a lot of expense. Or, you know, you could ask someone for a favor, which you can only do so often before you wear out your welcome. But grocery shopping is not really optional. So, You know, everyday activities that you really have to do were often quite difficult for these families, much less doing something like Christmas shopping, where families were, in July, going downtown and putting things on layaway for their children because they knew they couldn't afford to, you know, go out and do a big shopping closer to Christmas time. So they would plan way ahead. And, you know, kids, almost all the kids knew what their presents were before Christmas came because they would have to go downtown with their mothers or their grandmothers when they put, you know, the coat on layaway for Christmas. So there was a kind of transparency, I think, for these kids about how much things cost, how you, again, sort of provide for the needs of everybody in a household in a way that things are not often transparent for middle-class children, where they're more protected from, you know, the everyday cost of keeping a household going.
Yeah. I think that that's really interesting and really significant that that difference should be there. That and it may be really easy to understand when you see that a lot of these folks are living really close to the edge. Mm-hmm. That these children would know that they would have to know that there would really be no way that they could not have to know that because it's something they really have to live with.
Absolutely. I mean, when there's no food in the house, you know, you understand why. You know, there's no money. And children did come to school hungry. There were other children who, you know, the mother wasn't really around. There was one boy who was 11, and his mother was in her early 20s. And he was the oldest of four. And his mother, you know, would go out at night. And so he would be taking care of his little brothers and sisters, some of whom were still in diapers. And when he came to school, you know, he was so tired that he would go to sleep. And you can imagine how that affects then his ability to learn and his ability to get, you know, the skills that he needs to go on. But, you know, when you need to sleep because you've been up all night and you're 11, you know, so the teachers were, you know, really in a struggle about how to deal with this. And, you know, he didn't have the clothes he needed, he didn't have the food he needed, you know, much less a toy or you know, these things. And, you know, but he's watching the same TV that everybody else does and seeing commercials for this wonderful thing and that wonderful thing and wanting that, but not really having any real way to get it because what he really wants is some food on the table and, you know, a mother who will care for him.
We're in our midpoint here, just a little bit past, and I probably should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Elizabeth Chin. She is associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at Occidental College in Los Angeles, and we're talking about a study that she did in New Haven, Connecticut. Spent a couple of years with young black kids who lived there, looking at their participation in American consumer culture. And she's done a book-length treatment of the subject. It's titled Purchasing Power, Black Kids and American Consumer Culture. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. And your questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The kids that you got to know and spend some time with, did the elders, their caretakers, parents, did manage to provide them with a little bit of discretionary income.
Mm-hmm.
So they did have a little money to spend in whatever way that they wanted. How did they think about how they were going to spend that finite cash?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was an interesting thing about the money that children had. Even the families that were on welfare, the mothers would take part of their check and give their children an allowance. And they were very interested in teaching their children. They all talked about spending your money wisely. And so this was something that families really wanted to instill in their children. And kids were really encouraged to buy things that they needed. You know, sometimes they were actually expected to pay for their own underwear, for instance. Socks or school supplies, you know, and they also spent the money on chips, you know, walking to school, they might buy some candy, as kids do. But it was very striking the amount of almost pressure from families for children to be very practical in their spending. And this wasn't huge amounts of money. It was maybe $20 a month. So that was something that I had not been, you know, expecting to see necessarily, and it was an interesting thing to learn about. When one of the things I did was to actually give kids $20 and take them on spending shopping trips,
mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, really one of the most eye-opening experiences because, again, you're talking about 10-year-old children. I think people often think 10-year-olds don't have a lot of impulse control. You know, if you took a 10-year-old kid to the store, they would just be, you know, running around saying, oh, you know, I want to buy everything. And these kids were so directed. Many of them certainly bought toys for themselves or bought things for themselves. But I did about 23 shopping trips. And they knew me in the Payless shoe store. You know, I think 8 of the kids bought shoes with their $20 and had money left over. Some kids bought 2 pairs of shoes. And 2 of those pairs of shoes were gifts for mothers. And the girls in particular spent part of their money on presents for other people. And that was, again, something that I think doesn't go along with the popular ideas that people have about how any child, much less these kinds of kids, are likely to do. And they were very, very interested in their spending to connect themselves to their kin groups and their households. And, you know, one girl bought rollers, you know, hair curlers for her grandmother. And kids were buying, you know, again, socks, underwear, Clearasil, you know, deodorant, school supplies, clothes for themselves. So, you know, they weren't just buying toys and candy and junk and little stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting because it goes against stereotype in a way, because I think at some point in the book you talk about the fact that when you would tell people what it was you had done or were doing, mm-hmm. that people would say, oh, well, you must have seen a lot of Air Jordans,
yeah.
which are very, very expensive
yeah.
athletic shoes. And it cost more than $100 or,
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah, they did then.
And you, I don't know if you even tried to explain to these folks how wrong they were, but obviously they had this really wrong-headed idea. And it sounds like the reality was very, very different, that not only were these kids just, there was just way out of anything they could even think about, that their
yeah.
priorities were really very different. And they were, when you gave them $20, they were thinking about how far can I stretch this? And
yeah,
exactly. In fact, in a lot of cases, we're not thinking, in part they were thinking of themselves, but they were not even thinking completely of, always thinking completely of themselves.
Right, right. And, you know, they're also realists. I mean, they knew that with $20 they couldn't buy a pair of Air Jordans. That doesn't mean they didn't want them, but what's the point? You know,
yeah.
If you have $20, spend the $20 and, you know, you can still want the Air Jordans. And I think the other contextual thing to think about, though, is for a lot of these kids, and I only saw two pairs of Air Jordans, you know, among the children that I knew. One of them was owned by a kid whose parents both worked for the city and earned a combined annual income of $90,000, so they were actually doing very well. And another one had been a gift to a girl by her older brother who was a teacher. If you're a poor family, again, you might save up, put on layaway, something expensive like a pair of Air Jordans, but that might be the most expensive thing that you have. You know, mostly these are families that don't have cars. They don't own their own homes. You know, they don't own things that cost $1,000, let alone what a home costs. So I think it's also worth, instead of just saying, oh, Air Jordans, that's a $100 pair of sneakers, isn't that terrible? Shouldn't they be spending their money in a better way? It's useful to think of that in the context of, what if that's the most expensive thing that person has? And I think that shifts then how one might judge that particular thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Other people are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. And we're talking with Elizabeth Chin from the Department of Anthropology at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And she has put together a book dealing with this study that she did. The title is Purchasing Power, and it's published by the University of Minnesota Press. The subtitle, Black Kids and American Consumer Culture. We have a caller here in Charleston. It's line number 4. Hello?
Yes. I'm wondering if your guest has considered in her studies about capitalist economics,
mm-hmm.
you know, which we all live under, and how it's graded out into income levels,
mm-hmm.
how we acquire those income levels,
mm-hmm.
and addressing the subject of poverty,
mm-hmm.
and the haves and the have-nots, and mm-hmm. how that correlates with human rights. You know,
mm-hmm.
it should be our human right to have enough to eat and to have a livable life. And from what I've heard so far, you know, the other side always lives off in ghettos and everything is substandard.
Mm-hmm.
And to correlate that with capitalist economics and how it continues to oppress
mm-hmm.
90% of the world. And I wonder if that's part of your anthropological studies.
Absolutely. One of the things that I look at is the sort of social and economic history of New Haven, and in particular of New Hallville, which was the neighborhood where I did the work. somewhat ironically, Newhallville is the home of Winchester Repeating Arms, which is, you know, the famous Winchester rifles had long been made in New Haven. And so, for instance, in the 1940s, Winchester employed 12,000 people in 24-hour shifts. And by the time that I did my research in New Haven, Winchester employed 500. And so what happens to a community when nearly 12,000 jobs just from one employer go away? The people didn't go away. The jobs went away. And so one of those shifts, as the caller is saying, is, you know, the ability to earn money at a job suddenly has disappeared for these people. And, you know, what were once union jobs that you could get with a high school diploma, suddenly you need to go at least to junior college or have a four-year college degree to earn less money. And one of the big ironic things that happened was that the city was trying to redevelop the site of the factory into a science park, a sort of a research-oriented business area. And so the entire factory site had been fenced off. And it was not very successful at that time. Not very many businesses had been attracted to it. And one of the main tenants of the redeveloped site was this organization called the New Haven Family Alliance, which was a social service organization designed to help local families deal with the stresses of being unemployed. And so the people who used to work in the factory then had to ask a guard to let them onto the factory, the former factory site, in order to go to the appointments that they had with this organization that was designed to help them deal with their unemployment. So it was a little ironic.
Yes, to me, it addresses the issue that capitalism has failed, and it cannot provide only for a select few in every class with the necessities of life. And here in the good old USA, we are supposedly well off compared to third and fourth world nations, you know, I just saw a report yesterday about Zimbabwe, which their whole system is broken down over money and how that country had been looted by locals plus all the whites that had preceded, or gotten down there in 18th and 19th centuries. And now, I mean, it goes on and on, you know, somehow surviving when truly the system should be done away with and some more equitable system to replace it to give people those human rights, you know, to eat every day.
I think looking contextually also helps to show that, you know, one of the common things that are often said about poor people is, you know, well, if they would work hard, you know, they wouldn't be where they are.
Yes, sir.
And I think if you, even just looking at the particular situation that you see in New Haven, it's hard to imagine how the devastation of an entire community could be the fault of those particular individuals. And so that it is caught up in this larger system that is shaping people's lives and then giving them circumstances to deal with that they are not in control of. So again, in New Haven, urban redevelopment, which took place in the 60s and 70s, displaced 60% of the black community out of largely single-owner homes into housing projects, which are now being torn down because they became so horrible. So, you know, what happens when you displace 60% of a community?
Yes, well, it's always want and deprivation and all those other things.
Yeah, it was not a very, effective strategy.
Yes, and that's rampant, you know, throughout the country, you know, especially in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
All that began to shake and fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
It's still being lived out every day. I live in this small community, and there is those who have nothing and those who have everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm a Marxist. I I can see there's an answer through Marxism if we can ever get to a point where bourgeois class can be taken from power,
mm-hmm.
and and the workers to steer the ship in a different direction. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, ma'am, for your time.
We have a caller here, someone on a car phone, so we want to get right to them on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I actually lived right across from Science Park in New Haven.
Oh.
So I know exactly the part of town you're talking about. What I'm calling is, when I was there, the university as well as the city were trying to engage that community in some kind of redevelopment. What's happened since the early 80s with the university and that and the city and that project of trying to redevelop for those who are poor?
Right.
I don't know. That's the reason I'm asking. So.
Yeah, I'm a little bit out of touch. I have to say, I've been away from New Haven now for almost 10 years. But
okay, so we were there almost contemporaneously.
Uh-huh. I do know, you know, Newhallville, you know, isn't doing all that well. I think shortly before I left, you know, a lot of houses, the taxes had been raised. An average of 248% because
right.
they hadn't had a reassessment since the 70s.
Right.
And a lot of people couldn't pay their taxes anymore, so a lot of houses were getting torched.
Right.
But I do know that downtown there has been a, this was a couple years ago, but it's an ongoing problem. Yale and the city had entered into a development deal with Donald Trump to turn one of the hotels into a 4-star hotel. And what happened was that New Haven has a board of aldermen as
right.
part of its governance structure. And the board of aldermen did not read the fine print on the agreement, which required the city to move the main downtown bus stops 3 blocks away.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Off the green.
Yeah.
Off the town central green.
Right across, right there by Macy's.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they're not by Macy's anymore. They're down by State Street, which is 3 blocks.
Yeah. That takes forever to get there.
Yes, and so people were, as you can imagine, I mean, the Board of Aldermen kind of went, whoops, you know.
Of course.
And, you know, but Trump wouldn't let them out of it. And so the bus stops were moved, and that was widely viewed in New Haven as an overtly racist problem.
Well, I mean, it was. I mean, even the university would out and out say, don't go down Whaley Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was in the literature.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And when I was there, I intentionally lived in that neighborhood. I was a student at the university at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to, and those were the folks I wanted to work with.
Right.
And that's what I'm doing now. And I mean, part of what you're saying, part of the reason I'm asking is that you brought up all the memories of my neighbors.
Right, right. We
and this is
knew a lot of the same people.
Yeah, and this has been a very powerful conversation, so thank you.
Mm. All right, thanks for the call.
Thank
one thing that I wanted to ask you about, it's a little bit perhaps of a side issue, although I think it's fascinating, is the issue of ethnically correct dolls. And you
uh-huh.
have a section in the story about that, in the study about that, where you know, some people had made the argument that kids should have dolls that look like them.
Right.
And that if they do, then that will perhaps help them to feel better about themselves rather than toting around Barbies, for example, that would instill in them the idea that what you want to be is tall and blonde and have blue eyes, which they're never going to have. And so now we have ethnically correct dolls. And the question is, does that indeed really do anything for any child? Does it really matter what color their doll is, or is this just another opportunity for the people who make the dolls to sell some dolls?
Right. And I think it's a very complicated issue. So ethnically correct dolls, which, again, these were really becoming big business during the early 90s, are dolls that have faces that are molded to more accurately reflect different ethnic and racial groups. And one of the problems that I found was that the kids in this neighborhood didn't have them. And so one of my questions was, you know, how are children like these going to, you know, benefit from what ethnically correct dolls could potentially offer? But they're not getting to them, again, because you have the basic consumer problem of they can't get to Toys R Us, they don't have the money to buy these toys, et cetera, et cetera. And the industry, I think, was very clearly, you know, their business as the owner of, you know, the largest black-owned toy company told me, she says, you know, we're not a charity. We're not going to, you know, just give away these toys to children all around the country. We have to make money. And that's a realistic thing. So now I'm losing my train of thought a little bit. So on the one hand, yes, one can say, of course, it's good if we don't only have white Barbie dolls. But then the question is, does just manufacturing these diverse images solve the problem? And I think for me that answer was clearly no, because these children can't get access to that solution. Mm-hmm. And so there's this larger problem. Most of them had white dolls. And so what I saw, which I thought was very interesting, was kids who were taking white dolls and doing very, you know, these braided hairdos, beads, putting foil in their dolls' hair. And I didn't necessarily see that they couldn't relate to their dolls all of the time. So it wasn't clear to me that they were looking at their dolls and saying, that's a white doll. It represents this other world that I don't know anything about. Therefore, I can't relate to this doll. Or it wasn't also clear to me that they were saying, I want to identify with that doll as a white doll. Yeah. I think that their relationships with those dolls were much more complicated than that. And I think I'm a little skeptical, I guess, of, again, a solution like ethnically correct dolls, which are, you know, the $14.99, as a way of social change. I don't think it necessarily hurts, but I'm not really clear how much it helps. If that makes sense.
Sure. Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we've used our time, and we'll have to leave it at that with our thanks.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
We appreciate the time. Our guest, Elizabeth Chin, she is Associate Professor in the Department of Anthropology at Occidental College. That's in Los Angeles. And the book, if you'd like to look at it, is titled Purchasing Power, Black Kids and American Consumer Culture. And it is published by the University of Minnesota Press.